Good morning, friends, and welcome to Our Times with Craig Barnes, and I am Craig Barnes. There's perhaps no more interesting pursuit than to go back into history and unravel the record to see who did what to whom and why. According to the law, when two or more people band together to commit a crime, that is a conspiracy. And there have been a lot of conspiracy questions in history, from who killed Julius Caesar to who tried to kill Piero Medici in the 15th century of Florence, to who framed Anne Boleyn of England, accusing her of infidelity. That one cost her her head. Sometimes we know who the conspirators were. We know who plotted to kill Queen Elizabeth I of England because of a secret letter from Mary, Queen of Scots, that the spymaster Walsingham found in a beer keg. We know who plotted to throw King George III out of America because Adams and Payne and Henry were successful. And with success, they came clean, and all those conspirators became national heroes. We know a good deal less about who conspired to kill Abraham Lincoln or who killed Jack Kennedy, and not so much about who was in on the Watergate plot to break into the Democratic headquarters in an escapade that brought down Richard Nixon. Conspiracies are by definition secret, and therefore fertile ground for novels and historians, playwrights, and mumblers who just want to blame somebody for something. Anything that mumblers don't know, they can blame on a conspiracy, hidden and nefarious, and the cause of all their troubles. That is the origin of so-called conspiracy theories. Sometimes they are a substitute for mystery, just to make matters explicable. But every now and then, along comes someone who really does unravel a mystery, and that should solve the matter, right? Once the evidence is laid on the table about who killed Jack Kennedy or who brought down Richard Nixon, we all should accept it and change our minds about history, right? But of course we don't. We don't do that. We don't change our minds just because of the facts. That is especially true if the facts point to a conclusion that is real difficult to take on and is a shock. Today's guest is someone who has written just such a book and whose conclusions are a shock and who does have a conspiracy theory and who has been traveling the country, appearing on radio and TV, writing and publishing for more than 20 years. Russ Baker is an award-winning investigative reporter with a track record for making sense of complex and little understood matters, explaining it to elites and ordinary people alike, using entertaining, accessible writing to inform and involve. Over the course of more than two decades in journalism, Baker has broken scores of major stories. His topics have included early reporting on the inaccuracies in the articles of the New York Times, her author Judith Miller that built support for the invasion of Iraq. He's reported on the media campaign to destroy UN chief Kofi Annan and undermine confidence in multilateral solutions. And he's given us revelations about George Bush's biographer, that as far back as 1999, before he was elected, presidential candidate Bush already spoke of wanting to invade Iraq, etc., and etc. Baker has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation's, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and Esquire, and dozens of other major domestic and foreign publications. Welcome, Russ Baker.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Are you asleep when I'm listening to this intonation of all your records?
I've heard some of it before.
You may even have something to do with writing that at one point in your life. And, you know, I could say you're also a decent-looking fellow and nicely traveled, nicely manicured, but probably less relevant.
The other thing, I don't know if that's in there, is about our website, whowhatwhy.com, which is really where I have been putting almost all of my time for the last few years.
Good. Whowhatwhyallonword.com.
Right.
And your regular articles and your blogs and your comments on things going on in the world are there.
Yeah, we're actually building that up into a real journalistic enterprise with other reporters and editors and the whole thing.
Terrific. So this will be the newer, more progressive version of the Huffington Post?
Yeah, or maybe the newer, more progressive version of the New York Times.
Good. Well, the writing is certainly of that quality, I can say. Reading The Family of Secrets, it is, as you have said in your own writing, it's accessible, it's interesting. It's full of facts. It's well researched, and that's the kind of thing that a former lawyer like myself looks for. The book Family of Secrets has been endorsed by Bill Moyers and Dan Rather, people who are eminent, great figures in American journalism. and they congratulated you on doing research that they've not been able to do. And you point your finger in this book at the conspiracy or the combination of interests in the oil and gas industry and the CIA beginning in the 1940s. All the way back to the 1940s, as the CIA is founded or created out of the OSS of the World War II, CIA is created. And right away, you describe a mingling of interests with oil and gas magnets in this country. And they begin to support each other around the world. Let's begin at the beginning, because your conclusions that in about the 1960s become desperately serious. And I think we need to lay a foundation. So oil and gas and CIA together in the 1940s?
Yeah, I in the course of doing the research for Family of Secrets, and I had written about the CIA over the years, but I didn't really know all that much about its origins because the books I had read on it turned out to be inadequate. The CIA was something that Presidents Roosevelt and then Truman didn't want to happen. They thought no good would come of it, and they thought they got enough information already because there are really quite a few avenues for intelligence.
There's military intelligence, there's State Department intelligence, there's Navy intelligence, Army intelligence, Defense Department intelligence already.
Yes, and then there are also just travelers. And this is one of the most interesting ones, is just business people in particular, but other people who travel a great deal, who talk to other people, has been one of the primary methods with which information has been transmitted from abroad.
And the CIA – and so I didn't realize that, but both FDR and Harry Truman said, wait a minute, this could become maybe they didn't say this, but I begin to see it in your descriptions over the years as almost cancerous within the Democratic culture, taking on a role of its own and taking over the CIA becoming – and Truman and Roosevelt both – were omniscient about this or prescient about this? What?
Well, Roosevelt didn't want any peacetime separate intelligence agency, and Truman was reticent, but there was a tremendous amount of pressure. They created this bill. It was all-inclusive, and it created the Pentagon. It created the National Security Agency. It created the CIA. It created a whole bunch of these different things. The National Security Council were all created at the same time in the National Security Act of 1947. And Truman signed on to the small portion of that referenced a central intelligence agency because of the way they described it to him. They said it would be a central – see, it's interesting. We don't think about the word central, but that actually what that meant was it was a center into which all of the intelligence would pour. And so he was basically told, look, this will be a rather small office, and what it will be is just at your service. And so when you have questions and you're trying to make a decision, you can just turn to this office. They will have collected and collated intelligence from a variety of places and be able to provide it to you with a bit of analysis. And that's really what he was told he was signing on to. Years later, we know he was very, very unhappy with what it became because years later, in 1963, 30 days to the day after the death of John F. Kennedy, Harry Truman, in retirement, published an op-ed in the Washington Post in which he said basically – I'm paraphrasing here. He basically said the CIA is out of control. I never authorized it to become this huge sprawling outfit that was meddling and doing all of these things all over the world. And so we see that essentially he was tricked and it grew into this whole thing. They put little clauses in there like may from time to time perform other functions as you as a lawyer can appreciate how important this kind of vague language is as they may be directed.
And so from the 1947 creation through till 1963, this agency grows. And this is significant because your book, Family of Secrets, surrounds the events in Dallas at the day when John Kennedy was killed with CIA presence, at least. And later on, your book surrounds the deposition of Richard Nixon with CIA figures again, as if to say, and you don't come quite out and say it in Family of Secrets, that either the Bush family engineered either of these two things and tragedies in American politics. You don't say that directly, but you do create a compelling picture, an evidential picture of the CIA's presence in Dallas in 1963. But let's build to that, because this is not the kind of thing an average American wants to hear, as you well know, because you've been talking about this book, the public's all over. They say, are you kidding? And I don't want to hear it. And that's my own reaction. I don't want to hear it. So I'm struggling as, you know, I go through the 500 pages of your book and think, oh, God, that's true. So let's go through the 50s. This nexus between oil and gas, in which the Bush family was deeply involved, and the CIA is a surprising one to me. And you describe George H.W. Bush as having traveled on behalf of his oil, so-called oil interests, but you suggest that he was in those trips all over the world on behalf of someone else.
Right. We actually could go back and talk briefly about Alan Dulles.
Yes.
Who would become an early and important CIA director, probably the most important one, longest serving. Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, were corporate attorneys, and their firm represented some of the largest American multinationals, like, let's say, for example, the United Fruit Company, but also Standard Oil and all of these others. And what they were doing was they weren't just lawyers as we think of lawyers, but they were very much kind of like a mix of a lawyer and a lobbyist and an international power broker. And so whenever these companies had a problem abroad, typically with some leader, often democratically elected, for example, Arbenz in Guatemala, threatening the interests of United Fruit, later on of Fidel Castro in Cuba, and they would turn to these fellows in their law firm who then would take care of things. And often the way they would take care of things was through associates of theirs inside the U.S. government. And so if you go all the way back to the 1920s, pick up a copy, The Nation magazine, I think it's 1922, and they have I think it's a cover story, and it's about Nicaragua, and it says, the Republic of Brown Brothers. And Brown Brothers was a bank that would later be called Brown Brothers Harriman. Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W., the father of George H.W., a partner in this firm. They worked very, very closely with Alan Dulles and his brother and all these folks. And what you're looking at there are the real backstory of public policy. It's that public policy is created largely by private interest, always has been, probably always will be.
Let me see if I get this story right, interest, this is, should come as no surprise to us. This part is not shocking, at least not surprising, that the major New York corporate interests, already becoming global in the 1920s, 1930s and 40s, interrupted by the war, of course, but then becoming globally significant, are represented by people who, like Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, who bridge between their corporate interests and government, or create a way in which they can lead government into the service of these private interests, so that in that horrendous series of invasions in Latin America in the 1920s and 1930s even, they seem to have been an extension of U.S. power on behalf of corporate interests. That was clearly the case. And what you're saying now is that in the 1940s and 50s, Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, begins to, having stepped out of a corporate law firm, begins to use American power on behalf of those interests in a not benign way, right? I mean, they when governments like Arbenz were toppled, they weren't toppled nicely.
Right. And then the same thing happens the next year in Iran, where it's the British – who are the dominant oil power there.
This is 53?
Let's see if I have this right. It was, I want to say Guatemala 53 and Iran 54. I may have those
something
backwards.
Like that. Yeah. The early 1950s.
Yeah, they're both one right after the other. Yeah. And what you have is you have Mossadegh, who's also a democratically elected leader in Iran, and he has a problem with the British oil company there, the Anglo-American oil company there, basically running the country effectively, and he wants to put a stop to that, as you would imagine that a leader might well want to do. And so the British asked for the American help there in getting rid of him, and that's how we get the Shah of Iran and all the rest of the back history to why Iran is opposed to the United States today.
And Arbenz was killed, was he not? Arbenz in Guatemala?
You know, I'd like to say I know the immediate answer to all of that. I don't quite remember who was exactly killed. In the case of Iran,
Mossadegh was driven out.
He was driven out. He later, while he was jailed, you know, it's usually the way these things happen. It's always a little bit more complicated and murky. Like with Allende, certain people were said to have committed suicide. Also with Diem
in Chile, Diem in South Vietnam.
All of these tend to be murky. It's very, very rare in any of these cases that you had an explicit and overt assassination with which the United States or the British could be directly associated.
So those of us who remember the 1950s can remember that one of these regimes was toppled after the next. It was world front page news. And what we didn't know then was that there may have been didn't know until 20, 30, maybe 40 years later was that the CIA was deeply involved in these topplings, that Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, was the architect of what we would call criminal activity in foreign countries, all through the 1950s. Is that right? As part of the Cold War, and we're part of it, can be justified to the American people, justified to the Congress, justified, I suppose, to President Eisenhower, as a part of the battle against worldwide communism and necessary to preserve freedom.
That's true, although really none of the presidents were okay with this stuff. Eisenhower was very uncomfortable with all of it, didn't even want to hear much about it. And they had the doctrine of plausible deniability, whereby these things had to be done in such a way that the president could plausibly say, I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, okay. So that gets us a record which is shadowy. None of us really knew during the time. The presidents may have known to some degree, but I understand even presidents have trouble getting information out of the CIA and maybe did so even then. Alan Dulles is the head of the CIA. His brother, John Foster Dulles, is Secretary of State under Eisenhower. So the corporate interests are well represented in American government in spite of Eisenhower's own understanding of the dangers of military power. So we come then to the Bush family. And the Bush family, Prescott Bush, has been associated with Brown Brothers Harriman, which had these interests in Latin America. Prescott Bush is a senator. He's an important figure in American politics. His son, George H.W. Bush, goes to work in the Midlands oil fields in Texas and begins to develop a position as an oil driller. And now you suggest that his travels around the world are a bit bizarre. That they don't all make sense just from the standpoint of oil drilling.
Right. Just a quick background, by the way. Brown Brothers Harriman controlled a company called Dresser Industries, which we still find today. Now it's part of Halliburton. But Dresser was essentially run by Brown Brothers Harriman, the Bush family and their associates. And young George H.W. Bush, having finished at Yale, takes a so-called low-level job there. Later we find documents from Dresser officials talking about how proudly they served the CIA, helping the CIA recruit agents around the world. That's actually a document featured in my book, Family of Secrets. So you can see that's the milieu. Then George H.W. Bush leaves there and he starts his own company called Zapata Oil.
Hang on just a second. Yeah. I want to nail that Brown Brothers Harriman actually is on record, and you have documentation of that, of having been a recruiter for the CIA.
Dresser Industries. It was essentially a subsidiary, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, and then George H.W. Bush is in that milieu.
He's working for them as a so-called trainee. Yes,
uh-huh. Yeah. So, and we don't know exactly what that means.
We don't, right.
All right. And then we have to take a break. So we will do that to find out the storied or the unstoried career of George H.W. Bush. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes. We're talking to author Russ Baker, author of The Family of Secrets. We'll be right back. We're right back. We're talking to Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. And we are going into that 50 years because I think Russ, you will have met all over the country, and you've talked about your book in many places, including in Santa Fe. There is an incredulity about your conclusions, a lack of willingness to accept them. And therefore, I think we need to build this foundation, even in the 1950s. So we get through the 1950s, and George Bush, George H.W. Bush, is during this time beginning to travel around the world in to places that don't make sense from the oil and gas industry standpoint?
Right. The first thing he does is with some friends, they start this company called Zapata Oil. But then he starts a second company, and the people involved in Zapata Oil do not participate in the second company. The second one is called Zapata Offshore. Zapata Oil is a real company. It later becomes Pennzoil. So that's the Liedtke brothers, and they become fabulously wealthy. But George H.W. Bush is not really interested in money. He's interested in something else. So he starts as Zapata Offshore. They're going to be doing offshore drilling. And this thing, a bunch of money is pumped into it, including by the owner of the Washington Post, all kinds of very powerful people. And you say, oh, that's kind of odd. Well, how do they even know this young man out in West Texas? Anyway, he starts this company, Zapata Offshore. I studied it extensively, and it made no sense to me from a business standpoint. It never seemed to turn a profit, yet these wealthy people keep pumping, mostly in Washington, big amounts of money into it. And George H.W. Bush is traveling frenetically all over the world to places that have no offshore oil. They don't seem to have any customers for Zapata. And conveniently, he always seems to be getting together with or meeting with CIA station chiefs. So you can conclude what you will about that company, but all the evidence points to the fact that what it was commercial cover.
Well, this is an important little piece. If I were trying this lawsuit and building this case, that George H.W. Bush travels the world to places that don't make sense from an oil standpoint, but he's meeting with station chiefs. How do we know that? Aren't station chiefs secret people?
Well, later on in Family of Secrets, you see that he had met with, for example, Al Ulmer, who was the Athens station chief. Athens station was one of the most important ones in the Cold War battle. That was the battles not just for Greece, but for Bulgaria and Hungary. All of those places were being run out of there. And then Al Ulmer would end up being the coup master. He would try to overthrow Sukarno, the nationalist in Indonesia. He'd be involved in similar operations in other places.
And there's not a lot of oil in Greece, as I recall. So why would George H.W. Bush go to Greece to explore the oil question?
You know, when you go to the George H.W. Bush Library, they've tried so hard to redact everything about everything. But even so, you read between the lines and you can see that these trips were not for oil business.
So he has an association with, at least a talking association with, a conversational association with Alan Ulmer, who is the architect of coup attempts or assassination attempts during the 1950s. Is that right?
Al Ulmer, right.
Al Ulmer. Yeah. And he becomes important later on November 22nd.
Yep, they're together again, this time near Dallas, yeah.
Okay, so now is it conclusive in your mind that George H.W. Bush is operating for the CIA?
Yeah, there are so many different indications of that. First of all, his father, Prescott Bush, now a U.S. senator, is in charge of a kind of oversight of foreign operations. We actually quote somebody who was in on those intelligence operations who said that Prescott Bush flew out to Hong Kong to find out why an attempt to assassinate Chou Enlai of China had failed. They had tried to poison his rice bowl and something had gone wrong. So the father is deep into this stuff. The father is very close friend of Alan Dulles, Dresser Industries, their company, very, very involved with recruiting. And then, of course, there's George H.W. making his trips and meeting with all these very interesting characters.
This is what we in the law call circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of it. There's a lot of intertwining, inextricably, it almost seems, intertwined evidence of the Bush family associated with Alan Dulles, the CIA, CIA trips, CIA station trips, station chiefs. And this includes George H.W. Bush, and this is throughout the 1950s. So we've got him ostensibly and perhaps actually in the oil industry, but also so deeply intertwined with CIA figures that you have to assume that he's in conversation with them.
Well, we also have, very interestingly, a letter that is from Prescott Bush, or at least it mentions Prescott Bush, Alan Dulles, the head of Dresser Industries, and it mentions that they want to meet to talk about a new Caribbean initiative. This is coming from this private company, not from the CIA, and they're going to be starting this Caribbean initiative. This is around the time that George H.W. Bush starts Zapata, and then some years later we see them as Castro starts becoming a problem. Zapata starts putting these rigs off Cuba and staffing them with Cuban exiles, and you can imagine where that's going.
So what the rigs do, are they pumping oil?
We don't know. I've never been able to see any evidence that they did. It was very complicated. It was an island that Howard Hughes leased. It's all these interesting characters whose interests have dovetailed over the years. Howard Hughes leases the island. He leases it to Gulf Oil, on whose board is Kermit Roosevelt, who was in charge of overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran, and then George H.W. Bush is brought in as the drilling contractor within the Cuban exiles to supposedly work on the rigs.
I can remember my fourth grade teachers saying to me something, birds of a feather flock together, and so be careful of the friends you make. In the fourth grade, I was not accused, but I was aware that I should not hang out with the tough kids, the bullies. I should hang it. Craig, go steady. Don't do that. Birds of a feather flock together. And now we have a lot of birds of the feather surrounding Cuba in this place with a Zapata offshore and George H.W. Staffing that, running that, for reasons that may or may not have to do with oil.
Well, it's important to know that two different sides of the Bush family, the Bushes and the Walkers, had major investments in Cuba in large plantations there. And it's also important to know that friends of theirs, a man who becomes very important in my book, Family of Secrets, has just gotten from the pre-Castro Cuban government permission to drill for oil throughout the island. So you have all of these different dovetailing private interests at this time becoming very, very unnerved as Fidel Castro and his revolution begin appearing on the scene.
Okay, let's go to November 22nd,
sure,
1963.
Yeah.
Jack Kennedy is shot. A lot of people are in associated with the CIA are in Dallas at the time, or have been connected to Lee Harvey Oswald, who are also connected back to the CIA. And you've laid out that web in the Family of Secrets. It's a circumstantial case. There is no smoking gun, but there is a lot of evidence suggesting CIA involvement. Can you describe that web, and including George H.W. Bush, which is the shocking part?
Yeah, just as the framing for this, I Family of Secrets was intended to be an exploration of why George H.W. Bush became the most powerful person in the world and did the controversial things that he did. I went in with an open mind. I was curious to know if there was more to the story, and boy, was there more to the story. As I looked at the son, I began to realize that the father was a big part of the story, and we had to also study him and his rise to power. Looking at the father, I began discovering this whole back history that you're relating here, and I found that all these mysteries about H.W., including how in an interview he'd been asked, oh, where were you the day Kennedy was shot? What do you remember? What were your recollections of that? Just a benign question. And he sort of froze, and he was unable to say where he was when he'd heard that. And of course, whenever I do public speaking, including here in Santa Fe, I always ask audiences to raise their hands, how many of them were 5 years old or over that day? And how many of them don't remember where they were when they heard about Kennedy's assassination? Very, very few don't remember. And so, of course, so George H.W. said he didn't remember. He guess was not expecting the question. I began wondering where he was, because I was already seeing the outlines of a past that had never been reported before. George H.W. Bush had been named CIA director under Gerald Ford, apparently with no credentials, background, or relevant experience. And I wondered, why was he CIA director? That's when I began seeing the signs that he actually did have a secret background in CIA work. Then I became interested in his not remembering where he was when Kennedy was shot. And in Family of Secrets, I have, I think, four or five chapters of almost all new information on the Kennedy assassination, something I, Craig, had no opinions on, as they say, no dog in that fight. I don't think anybody knows me had ever heard me express any opinion whatsoever about what that was, about Oswald, if he did it, if he acted alone. But I, this is how I do my investigative journalism, both in Family of Secrets and on our website, whowhatwhy.com, is I try to go in with an open mind and a hunger for knowledge. There I said, well, let's figure out where George Bush was and what he was doing. And that's when I began to see his connections to not only all of these CIA figures who were in and around Dallas, but also military intelligence. And this is perhaps even more important because I discovered, and this has been documented in other very fine books that are out there, about Jack Kennedy's increasing struggle with the Pentagon, with the top people at the Pentagon, who were actually in favor of Lyman Lemnitzer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, actually had presented a proposal to Kennedy to start a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And he expected to have a nuclear war. He expected to have serious fatalities on both sides. And he said, but we will in the end win. Kennedy thought they were insane. He began pulling away from them. And at this point, a group that appears to include top people at the Pentagon, Alan Dulles, who Kennedy fired over the Bay of Pigs, people in the oil industry who were very unhappy about the oil depletion allowance possibly being taken away from them, people in the steel industry, a lot of people who just know each other began talking, it appears, and being very, very unhappy with Jack Kennedy and feeling that he really had become a serious, serious liability.
So we're talking about motive.
Yeah,
and of course the way in which we've all dealt with this over the last years has been to say that this was somehow connected to the Soviet Union, somehow connected to Cuba, somehow connected outside, and what you just described is a collection of interests internally that liked Jack Kennedy. It's one thing to not like him, and one thing to resist him, and one thing to be offended by him, and another to actually create the circumstances in which he might be killed. So let's take that very gently. That's very disturbing. So you're saying that military intelligence, the oil and gas industry with its Kennedy's assault on the oil depletion allowance, or the expected assault on the oil depletion allowance,
the steel industry, the sugar industry, excuse me, I mean many organized crime, the so-called mafia. Brother Robert Kennedy was using the FBI to go after organized crime. J. Edgar Hoover was friends with many of the organized crime figures, very, very unhappy about this. They were basically it was a hornet's nest. The Kennedy brothers were really, as they say, like bats out of hell, increasingly, not at the beginning, but as time passed, they began saying, you know, there's corruption everywhere. There's double dealing everywhere. There are the nefarious things going on in the government. There are crazy people in the Pentagon. The CIA people are going to get us into war with deceptions such as the Bay of Pigs, where they were trying to trick John F. Kennedy into committing U.S. troops to a full frontal invasion of Cuba. And he had said, I'm never going to do that. We don't have the time here to go into all these things, but John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, as the years passed, and there were only less than 3 years, began taking on more and more of these power centers, and that takes enormous guts. We've never seen a president or an administration since that did anything remotely like that. And because the message is clear, and I think today it's very, very relevant under a Barack Obama who understands there ain't no way you can do that.
You can't take on these centers of embedded power.
Not at all.
Or you can, but you're alleging that you're not alleging, actually. You're creating in your chapters in your book, and I have read them, that the circumstantial case that surrounding the events on November 22nd, 1963, there was some unexplained activity by George H.W. Bush and people who knew him well.
Many of those. And so just for example, Lee Harvey Oswald, whatever you make of him, the fact is that from late from the fall of 62 until the spring of 63. So right up until 6 months before the assassination, there was an older man who was almost kind of like a father figure to him, literally helping him find housing and jobs and driving him to the dentist and babysitting. And this man by the name of George de Morenschild was a Russian anti-communist emigre with very important connections in oil companies and in intelligence. And then we find that that same man, George de Morenschild, was an old and dear friend of George H.W. Bush. So even if you want to dismiss this, you find out that the man who becomes CIA director and president is a close personal friend of the close personal friend of the man who killed John F. Kennedy. If you had nothing else, you would at least want to know more about that.
So the George de Morenschild, Oswald comes back from Russia. He's married Marina. He's come back. He's become disillusioned with
– Or so they say.
So they say. Disillusioned and with life in the Soviet Union. He comes back. He's immediately taken under wing by this high society figure. George de Morenschild is a high society. He's not a schlepper at the dockyards. He's not a janitor at the book depository. And he has no obvious reason for taking on a Russian or a fellow who's defected to the Soviet Union and then undefected and come back. He has no apparent reason for doing that, but he squires him around town in Dallas. He sets him up. He finds ways to make Marina more comfortable. And at the same time, he has a record of having traveled the world on behalf of the CIA. Is that right?
That's right. And major oil figures as commercial cover.
And he's on boards of major oil companies.
He's not on boards of them, but he's connected for and he works for all of these people like Clint Murchison, who owned at one point more than 100 different oil companies alone. People like that, the George and Herman Brown of what would become Brown and Root, later KBR, this giant firm today. It's part of Halliburton that goes into Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere. He was plugged in with all of these people. And he was the uncle of George H.W. Bush's roommate in prep school. And so all of these people are very, very close over the course of decades and decades.
So there's this kind of a social network. We're beginning to see from Family of Secrets that there is a social network that has deep roots in the Yale Skull and Bones, or what is it called?
Skull and Bones, yeah.
Skull and Bones, right. Secret Society, that they've known each other, many of them, for years, that they know Kellogg, what becomes Kellogg, Brown and Root, Brown and Harriman. They're connected to all of that. And they become director. Connected to the director of the CIA and the Secretary of State.
It's what they call the old boys network,
and it really does exist.
Yeah. Oh, listen. It's you know, this is has to do with the legacies of getting into the good Ivy League schools, who they marry, their father-in-law gets them a job in a certain company. I mean, this is what makes the world go round.
Well, and there's a lot of this that's quite benign. I mean, there's a lot of it.
It can be used in benign ways, and it can be used in malign ways.
One is very lucky if one is born to wealth and born to connections and.
Yeah.
It's not a crime
to be
born wealthy.
No. And many people don't do the kind of things we're talking about.
Yes, and many of them have wonderful lives. So we're not condemning wealth. We're not condemning social status.
I should mention, by the way, that some of the whowhatwhy.com is a nonprofit, and some of our biggest donors are people from the exact kind of families you're talking about who read my book, Family of Secrets, and they said, my God, you really do understand how this works. They were not involved, but they saw it.
Yes. So here is a collection of interests, some of whom connect to the Bush family. And George de Morenschild is connected he's a friend of George H.W.
We actually, in Family of Secrets, have correspondence between the two
Two of them, yeah. So that they know each other. And then in a bizarre way, George de Morenschild is actually the escort for Lee Harvey Oswald. for 6 months?
Well, yes. And one of the funniest things is that later on, years later, when George H.W. Bush becomes director of the CIA, George de Morenschild writes him a letter. And he says, please, you got to help me. I guess I've been talking too much about Lee Oswald, but I'm an old man now and I can't harm anybody. And there seems to be a net closing in on me. Maybe it's the FBI. Would you please do something about it? Obviously, that's an indiscreet letter that gets sent up by Director Bush's staff to him. And they say, we assume this is a crank letter. You don't really know this guy, do you? But he's in a problem because it can be identified that he does know him. So he says, well, yeah, I do know him. He was the father, the uncle of a school friend of mine. And he said, yeah, he knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And then he says, I don't remember the details. Now, you know, just any normal human being, if your good friend was a friend of the person who shot the president of the United States, I don't think you'd say, I don't remember the details.
Well, yes. So George H.W. is not being entirely candid about all of this, clearly. All right. On the date, November 22nd, de Morenschild is no longer escorting or esquiring Oswald around. There's been a handoff.
Yes.
In your language, there's been a new handler.
Yeah, what he does is he's told to leave the country because, see, he's already connected to Bush and all of these other people. So they need to not have him around on November 22. So what they do is he basically goes out to Haiti on some sort of a project. And before he goes to New York and he meets with, all the evidence suggests, a man named Devine. And this man named Devine, I discover, is George H.W. Bush's business partner. And they meet in the Knickerbocker Club in New York, and then de Morenschild leaves the country. But before he goes, he takes Lee Harvey Oswald to a cocktail party where they're introduced to Ruth Payne, a Quaker woman who it is not revealed in most major books, but it was actually a close friend of Alan Dulles. And she becomes the new handler for Lee Harvey Oswald.
So Lee Harvey handler is the word that you choose because it looks like
it looked like a
spy story, and it certainly he's traded off. And it's bizarre that a fellow of this insignificance is meeting people who know Alan Dulles and meeting people who are connected to George H.W.
Well, he would be later characterized, you know, as a young, extremely rude, fanatical, abrasive, wife-beating, you know, person. Why would, as you point out, why would these kinds of people take any interest in him?
We have to take a break. You're listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes. We're talking to Russ Baker in his fascinating book, about his fascinating book, Family of Secrets. It's taking us all this time just to build up to this shocking business, but I think it's important. This is Our Times with Craig Barnes. We'll be back. And we're back. You're listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes. We're talking to Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets. And Russ, we're building to the case of where a bizarre connection exists between Lee Harvey Oswald and handlers in the CIA and George H.W. to the CIA in his own case. And these people are involved in November 22nd.
Well, you know, this is the issue is, are they involved or are they not? What I put together in Family of Secrets are literally hundreds of specific facts that have not been contested and I don't believe are contestable. Now, as you're a lawyer, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, when you look at a certain number of established facts that are all documented, we've got to 50 or 60 pages of footnotes in Family of Secrets, you begin to say, now, when you take all of those things, would a jury convict or would they not? Here are some more examples of things. We find out that on November 22, we find out later two documents are declassified, two FBI documents. They both relate to November 22, and they both mention George Bush.
George H.W.
Yes. And so these are very, very interesting because this is the man who says he doesn't remember where he was that day. Now we know he's a lifelong friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor, handler, whatever you want to call him. And now we find out that there are two FBI documents, not CIA, but FBI documents mentioning him in connection with some knowledge of things going on that day.
Yes. So George H.W. is in Dallas. on the morning of.
Well, this is what we discover. As I reveal, I believe for the first time ever in Family of Secrets, that George H.W. Bush was actually in Dallas the night, staying at the Sheraton Hotel the night before, November 21, and then he only resurfaces at 1:45 p.m. This is about an hour after the shooting, in a town not far from Dallas, where he calls the FBI, identifies himself by name, address, and occupation, identifies himself as a civilian, and actually says, I am calling. I've heard the president's been shot, and I may have some information on who shot him. Now, again, if you just add this up, again, the person saying I can't remember where he was, but another document shows that he was actually called the FBI. I have to say, out of all the Americans, I think very few called the FBI to say they knew who shot the president. So this sets him apart again in a most extraordinary way.
A bizarre piece of this is that he's fingering somebody in his own office in Republican headquarters in Harris County, Texas.
Right. Well, this is one whole chapter in Family of Secrets is just about the so-called Parrot phone call, in which he calls about a young man named James Parrot, and he says, "You better check this guy out." Now, when I investigate all of this, we find that this appears to be a ruse. That when he calls the FBI, he doesn't call the Dallas office; he calls the Houston office. The man answering the phone, although he doesn't say so in his report, is a friend of his. They take down the report, and instead of going and grabbing the suspect, they actually have the suspect come in of his own free will into a Secret Service office, and they clear him. And how do they clear him? They clear him because while George Bush is fingering this man, George Bush's assistant is clearing the man, saying, oh, no, I was with him. He couldn't have been involved in shooting the president. And so you have to conclude that phone call itself was for some other reason than actually trying to track down
the
assassin.
So your construction of this rather bizarre call from Tyler, Texas, where George H.W. was at that point, was to create an alibi or a what? To create an identification of where he was?
Yeah, this is what you call...
You're not suggesting in all of this that George H.W. somehow pulled the trigger on Jack Kennedy or set up the assassin.
No indication that he had that particular skill set or would have been inclined to do that at all. No.
Or that he hired the assassin.
Nothing like that. Look, the thing is this, is I'm very precise in my work, and I think this is why I have the reputation that I do. And this is why, by the way, you mentioned Rather and Moyers, but we have others on the cover right there. You have Gore Vidal, who himself was related into the Kennedy clan and is considered one of the top political historians in this country. And he was absolutely blown away by Family of Secrets. So we're very careful in everything. And so here people always say to me, "What are you not suggesting?" Blah blah blah. I say I'm telling you all of these facts. I do think they point to some sort of awareness, foreknowledge, concern to create an alibi for something. Now, we also find out that he was closely connected to a man who ran a secret military intelligence unit in Dallas. They were actually running at the time on the Republican ticket together for U.S. Senate and governor. They knew each other. They interacted with each other, all again documented in Family of Secrets. And the other man ran a military intelligence unit that was very closely linked with the oil industry, with Russian emigres. They knew George DeMarenshall. They knew all these people. They were shadowing Oswald. And even more interestingly, I think, is the fact that I discovered, and I've never seen this anywhere else, that something like 60 members of the Dallas Police Department moonlighted as members of this secret military intelligence unit at that time.
So wait a minute. This is going by like
there's a lot of stuff in here.
There's a lot of stuff. But this fellow's name was Crichton, right?
Yes, very good.
And Crichton was running for governor at the same time that George H.W. was running for the Senate in Texas. And they were all associated with the oil industry.
Yeah.
And Crichton was also the creator of this military intelligence unit, which would have not been too far from the kind of intelligence work that you suppose George H.W. was involved in with the CIA.
Right.
And they might have been in some way in the same conversations together. They were certainly in the same conversations politically because they were running on the Republican ticket. Now, in Family of Secrets, you also point out that Crichton's lieutenant or Crichton's associate or somebody associated with Crichton, straighten me out, was leading the motorcade of Jack Kennedy and caused the motorcade to stop in front of the Texas Book Depository.
He had a superior, I want to say, it's hard to remember so many, Family of Secrets has literally thousands of names. I think his name was Whitmire, Lieutenant Colonel Whitmire, I believe. He was actually a superior of Crichton, and he forced his way into the pilot car for the motorcade. He wasn't even supposed to be in there. Suddenly all these things started happening and people said, get out of the car. I'm getting in this and this and this. And yes, the car was essentially made to either completely stop or almost completely stop at the moment at which Kennedy was hit.
So the superior officer to Crichton, who would not have taken orders from Crichton,
no,
and was not in his unit, not in
no,
his secret
no,
intelligence unit.
No, higher.
For some reason, climbs into the motorcade
yeah.
and says, give me a seat. And the motorcade comes there, comes to a halt in front of the Texas Book Depository, which is owned by?
Well, now we get to another person, a man named D. Harold Byrd. D. Harold Byrd had started something called the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol, which was a kind of a paramilitary unit in which a young Lee Harvey Oswald trained. D. Harold Byrd was also a good friend of and sometime employer of George de Morenschild, who was squiring Oswald. And so Oswald ends up in the building owned by Mr. Byrd.
Oswald ends up in Mr. Byrd's book depository. It's called that shortly before the event. And he then purportedly does the deed. And the building is owned by an associate of de Morenschild. De Morenschild is an associate of intelligence networks, at least, is involved in conversation with them. Some of those conversations involve George H.W., our lifelong friend. And your suggestion, I think, is perhaps most interesting if it's not about George H.W. so much, who clearly did not may not even have been in on the plan. We have no idea. But we don't even know that this was not a Cuban thing or a Russian thing. We don't know any of that. But your suggestion, this evidence points strongly toward the CIA.
I think it's bigger than the CIA. I mean, some of these thoughts are post-publication, continue to gather more information, continuing to analyze and to think. In Family of Secrets, I'm extremely careful, as I said, to just lay out a lot of facts and let the reader come to their own conclusion. Since then, I have been willing to go a little bit further in making certain statements. And I'll just say this. Some of the biggest fans of Family of Secrets are ex-intelligence, ex-military people, and they come to me and they say, I love your book. You see, the reason that us mortals find this all so fantastical is because we've never been involved in these kinds of operations. If you talk to somebody who's in any of these special operations, Navy SEALs, people who've been in part of what we describe at our website, whowhatwhy.com, the operation in Libya that took Gaddafi down. This is never reported in the corporate-owned press, but I mean that was an intelligence operation involving liaisons with the French, Italians, British, American intelligence, actually creating the uprising there. These operations involve working with cover, working with manipulating well-meaning people who don't know what's really going on. They're very, very elaborate, and they go on all over the world almost on a daily basis. So the notion that how could it be possible that a person would get into a car and slow a motorcade or somebody would be asked to hire somebody in their building without any additional knowledge of what was going on. I mean, these are routine, what you call tradecraft in military and in intelligence covert operations. That's how these things work.
The point – I'm looking at the – cancer of the CIA at the center of American democracy, running these illicit operations. Certainly we now have a substantial history about what they've done overseas, and you're drawing the circle around the Kennedy assassination that in a court of law, I have to say, if I put all this evidence in, I think there'd be enough to convict the CIA I don't think there's enough to convict George H.W.
I have to say, by the way, that it's entirely possible that this was not a CIA operation, that it was an operation involving some people who either were in or had been in the CIA. It's very important to understand that there is no clear line between what is official and what isn't. Much of what goes on around the world is never authorized by Congress, and it's never even financed by the taxpayers. We know this historically. There's been testimony over the decades about the use of in Laos and things like that, permitting, let's say, things like the drug trade to finance gold, other things, to finance operations that are off the books, essentially.
Let me see if I can understand this, because my mind wants to say, where is the – how does this come together? What is the governance problem or the governance that's actually happening? And this, the way you're framing it, directs me to think that there is a, and we hear this from so many other sources that it's confirmed, that there is a kind of global corporate exchange, a network of people who know each other, and economic interests that are tightly intertwined, that in some cases takes action, as in Latin America in the 1920s and 30s, or as in South Asia in the 1960s, or as in Cuba over and over, that this international nexus of secret-run corporations has in fact a dominant role to play in the unfolding of American political events.
Well, if I may, Craig, just to bring it up to the present, we talk a little bit now about super PACs, thanks to Stephen Colbert and so forth. And that is essentially a continuation of the same kind of thing. It's a form of a conspiracy. It's a number of very, very wealthy people who want to hide their role in determining who will be president. So they have these front people like Karl Rove and so forth who aren't calling the shots but are executing the game plan. They are able to – they have friendly judges who are willing to pass – to make certain votes that allow these things with corporate personhood and what have you. This is how things get done. And I think what we're really looking at, the larger story here, is the ongoing hijacking of democracy. And it begins to explain your own wonderful movement here in Santa Fe, you know, these movements for real democracy, to try to educate ourselves in understanding why is it that we the people who supposedly run the country rarely seem to get what we want. That's what this is all about.
And the implication is that that there is no limit, that there is no civilized or legal limit to which large economic interests might go in order to control American and global politics, so that it can be pretty nasty.
It's a ruthless game, and I think Romney now is in a little bit under pressure, because as you begin to understand things like even how someone like that makes his fortune, it's nasty and it's dirty, and he doesn't want to talk about it, and we don't want to talk about it.
Well, you know, we don't. I desperately resist in my own heart.
Sure.
Evidence that there's a kind of corruption in American government. I'm less eager to resist the sense of the takeover of global politics by big money, which seems to be abundantly apparent in multiple manifestations. So that Family of Secrets does lead us through that in a brilliantly detailed way. Russ Baker, thank you for being here for that. Your website again is?
WhoWhatWhy.com.
All one word, who, what, why, lower caps, all through. And there you can find blogs and information and contributions by others, and you're creating an online competitor to the New York Times and Huffington Post. You've been listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes. Our guest has been Russ Baker, Family of Secrets, and we will be back next week with another interesting view of history. Thank you for listening.